For a material that started out as rotting vegetation at the bottom of primordial swamps, coal has made quite a name for itself. By fueling the Industrial Revolution, it altered the course of human history. And although its use has declined in recent decades, coal continues to supply about one-fourth of the nation's electricity and more than half of the power consumed by Hoosiers. Coal also sparks a good deal of heat at the Indiana State House as policymakers clash over the pace of the state's all but inevitable transition to natural gas and renewable energy. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll fire up the debate over the state's energy future. Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house. And joining me for what promises to be a high energy discussion, pun very much intended, are Republican Representative Ed Soliday of Valparaiso, Chair of the House Utilities, Energy, and Telecommunications Committee, and co-chair of the state's 21st Century Energy Policy Development Task Force. Democratic Representative Matt Pierce of Bloomington, the ranking minority member of the House Utilities, Energy, and Telecommunications Committee, and a member of the aforementioned Energy Policy Task Force. Former State Representative Matt Bell, now a State House lobbyist who serves as Chief Executive Officer of Reliable Energy, a trade association created late last year to promote Indiana's coal industry. And Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, which bills itself as Indiana's largest environmental policy organization. Thank you all for being here for a timely discussion, since we have about a million people as we tape this in Texas who are have no power because of the collapse of the power grid in that state. So very much top of mind. Obviously, we're going to talk a lot about what you all want to see happen this session, but let me start by asking you to speculate briefly about what the energy and environmental scene would look like, the landscape would look like in Indiana in, say, 10 years if the General Assembly did nothing this session or on that topic or anything for the next 10 years. Ed Soliday, what would Indiana look like?
Well, I don't think anyone who tells you they know probably isn't following what's happening in this rapidly changing world. There is high demand for renewables. We can debate global warming, and we're probably not going to change anybody's mind. But the fact that people want renewable is here. So how much they would want it, viewing what's happening in Texas, they probably are not going to be enthused about overbuilding in renewable. I and some others feel that we need to have a reasonable balance of fuel sources and enough generation capacity to meet peak demand. And we used to think peak demand was only in the summer, but we just learned peak demand also occurs in the winter. Everything that could generate electricity in this state was running in the last few days. We were selling a lot to others, and that's a good position to be in. So I think if you did nothing, you could see emotional swings one way or the other that probably wouldn't be healthy. Those states that have gone heavily renewable too fast before and thought they could buy from other states have wound up in trouble this summer and now again this winter. So the utility industry over the years has tended to swing from side to side. Enron is a good example. So I think having a and remember, our utilities here in this state are monopolies. And we create competition for them through government. So the legislature needs to take an active role, because if the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission were here, they'd say the legislature sets the policy and we carry it out. We don't do policy.
Lots to follow up on, and we will, but I don't want to shut out everyone else in this discussion. Matt Pierce.
I do think that no matter what the legislature does, the market forces really are pointing toward renewables. These bigger manufacturers use a lot of energy. They want sustainable, renewable energy. So I think the market's signaling we want to go that direction. I think the problem is if the legislature doesn't put in place some good proactive policies, we would have a less efficient, less smooth transition to those renewables. And I think it's from my opinion, I think we should be doing all we can to accelerate this transition into a carbon-free energy economy. And, you know, that's a big challenge, but we can do some things to assist it if we put good policies in place.
Of course, NIPSCO announced this week that two of its first two wind farms are fully operational. That's a utility in northern Indiana that's spelled out plans to do away with all fossil fuel burning plants, I believe, by, 2028?
Well, that's the interesting thing. We've gotten to this tipping point because 10, 15 years ago, when I was promoting legislation to promote renewables that were just starting to get off the ground, the utilities were like, this is horrible. You can't do this to us. And now they're the ones actively saying, don't get in the way of our moving into renewables. So it's a new world we're in.
More to chew on. Matt Bell, first, 10 years. Get out your crystal ball.
Without action from the legislature in 10 years, Hoosiers would be paying a lot more for the power that they use. During this transition that we're talking about, we've seen Indiana's price for energy go from about sixth lowest nationally to be in the mid-20s or even the high 20s, depending on what study that you read. The legislature, and I think to their credit, Representative Saldi and Representative Pierce both described it, are acting to ensure that this transition is smooth. Part of that transition is affordability as well. Our utilities are rushing to retire fossil fuel plants, continue to assess their customers for the price of those plants, and build new plants. So without action from the legislature, the Hoosier ratepayer is going to have a lot of cost hung on them over the next 10 years while we move to the evolving mix of resources that Representative Saldi and Representative Pierce mentioned.
And what would be the state of the coal industry in Indiana without any legislative action? Would it exist in 10 years?
So as we looked last night, 51% of the energy being generated in MISO is generated from coal. So as folks wake up this morning and turn on their lights, think of Hoosier coal miner that you're able to do that. I believe that there is a role for coal to play, not only in 10 years, but really in 20 and 30. And that's because we have to have a backbone of reliable, dispatchable, and affordable energy. And I think the circumstances this week really make that case for us. It's important to have that, and Indiana will be there to supply the world.
And as you often point out, the industry, while it's smaller than it used to be, certainly it's employs, what, about 2,500 people and is worth about $750 million a year in terms of the economy in Indiana. Jesse Carbonda, 10 years without legislative intervention.
Yes, two thoughts come to mind, John. One is that would mean that Indiana utilities would be governed by existing law, and that would mean that they would really go by their integrated resource plans, which suggests this pretty systematic transition from a fossil fuel-dominated economy to one that would be powered by both utility-scale renewables plus utility-scale storage. The second thing that would happen in that scenario would be a missed opportunity to really invest in making the grid more resilient, which of course gets all the more relevance in the context of the Texas winter storm. So it would mean foregoing opportunities to invest in energy efficiency, which means reducing everyone's energy load, and in decentralizing the grid so that if some generation assets on the grid get knocked out for extreme weather reasons, other parts would continue to function, just as it happened with Superstorm Sandy.
Well, now that we've gone a decade ahead, let's go 2 years back to the creation of the task force we talked about earlier that you co-chaired at Saldi, and Matt Pierce, you were a member of. And you got a lot of attention nationally at Saldi at the time of that creation because it was attached to, I don't know if you ever used the word moratorium, but a slowdown in the construction of alternative plants, or basically telling everybody, and this is not the official language, but just take a deep breath, don't do anything until we figure this out as a state. You met, you came up with a plan, now you want to extend, that expired, it went out, it sunset in what, November, you want to go another 2 years. Why?
Well, first of all, energy topics are very complex. Quite frankly, to the public, a little bit boring. And you touch one thing and it changes something else. So we had over 100 testimonies during that time to help us get to a position that I think the administration has bought into, and that's we want to encourage renewables without compromising reliability or affordability. and trying to reach that balance. So we spent most of our time just looking at how the grid operated, what our contribution needed to be, and so forth. In this, and I may be repeating myself, the tough thing of being chairman of this committee versus my 10-year chairmanship of transportation is you have to cut through the hyperbole on both sides to get to what's fact. So we left a lot of things on the table. For example, electric vehicles. Who is going to be able to do the retail sales? Should the big utilities which are monopolies, control everything from the generation to the retail, or should there be other opportunities?
Rooftop solar panels, another one that sure. ties into...
And we keep hearing that is just the panacea, is going to save the world. All we have to do is mandate them. And I live up where we have 24 inches of snow right now, and I want to know who's going to pay for those heat pumps and where we're going to get the electricity if we don't manage the grid well. So we've got that. We've got securitization. We have a number of topics that we need to explore that are very complex.
And so this would continue more or less as it has, but with a different composition. And Matt Pierce, that's something that you've raised questions about. Fewer gubernatorial appointments, fewer experts, and essentially no guarantee that there is any representation on the part of Indiana consumers. What's the problem here?
Well, I think that the initial task force had a pretty broad makeup. And when you do these kind of summer study things, there are a couple ways you can do it. You can either put all the stakeholders on there and kind of let them battle it out and hope that you can reach kind of a compromise. Or you can try to have it mostly dominated by people who are more objective, who theoretically have the independent knowledge of these industries that can kind of give you some objective, you know, advice and analysis. And I think we were kind of a little closer to that model in the last task force.
You had an even breakdown, for instance, among lawmakers, yeah. Republican and Democrat, which I think your plan at Holiday actually would now be heavily Republican. But you said that's a representation, a byproduct of the election. So I guess another example of election has consequences.
Yeah. So anyway, my point was that if the goal of any kind of task force or summer study committee is to try to reach a consensus on what is done so that when you get legislation before the full General Assembly, it has a smoother path. I think if you're going to achieve that, you need to have more balance in those summer. And the summer study committees are normally balanced. Now, I know this is a task force, but, I mean, the summer study committees have a slight advantage to the majority party because they get to name the co-chairs. But the kind of the rank and file appointees of the different caucuses are normally equal. And that's just not the case with the current task force that's moving through the session now.
Matt Bell, how significant is the work of, and presumably this panel will be reconstituted. The bill seems to be sailing through the General Assembly, is in the Senate now. So do you have put a lot of stock into what they come up with over the next couple of years?
I give all members of the task force tremendous credit for the work that they've done over the last couple of years. To a person, I think that they did exactly what Representative Pierce described, and that was dive deep into the issues, understand the impact of the decisions that they made. It created a wonderful forum for exchange for every stakeholder. There was the opportunity for us to tell our story. There was the opportunity for Mr. Carbondo's folks to tell theirs. It was a mature and thoughtful way to approach policy, and I have no reason to believe that it won't be the same going forward.
Jesse Carbondo, do you think that the task force is a legitimate fact-finding group, policy-making group, or do you think, as some do, that it's simply political cover for those who want to prop up the coal industry?
That's a complex question, John. I think that...
And you have 10 seconds to answer, but...
we participated in the task force in the first process 3 different times. We appreciate the number of topics, energy efficiency, distributed generation, electric vehicles, and others that are being discussed then. I think that if we truly want to make, energy policy a data-driven process, then... something as complex as something like securitization, which is being discussed in SB 386, ought to be deferred until the task force.
And that's effectively finding a way to pay for the new plant and the retirement of the old plant in a way that doesn't sock consumers.
Right, exactly.
And So it's a lot to chew on here. And so that's a bill, the securitization piece of legislation. That's one of the elements. You talked about the renewal or reconstitution of the task force. Two other bills that happen to be bear your name, Ed Soliday, that appear likely to win enactment would be a reliability mechanism that basically utilities would have to prove to the IURC, the Utility Regulatory Commission, that they can provide power in a reliable manner. And if they can't, then steps would be taken. And then also, you want to dictate the siting of wind farms. And in doing so, maybe usurp, some would say, the role of local government. We could spend hours on this, but I want everybody a chance to talk, but what's behind these bills?
Well, actually, there's only about 40 counties in the state of Indiana that can support wind, that have enough wind to make it viable. 32 banned or put a moratorium on wind, and we're going to be buying renewable. And transmission is expensive. One of the most rapidly rising costs in electricity is transmission. So early in the morning, we're buying a lot of wind right now from the Dakotas and Iowa and so forth. The pipe just isn't big enough to meet peak demand. So what happened was there was a group of people traveling around the state who were anti-renewable, and they were literally intimidating the county commissioners and so forth. So what we said was, why don't we share responsibility with the commissioners and set some standards? And what sort of escaped in the hyperbole was they have room to our standards that we have set are probably the most restrictive, more restrictive than any contract that's been signed. So they have room to negotiate. It's not a dictatorship, and just I would say this, I hear about local control. I looked, it's not in the Bible, it's not in the Constitution. It's a good management technique to make decisions happen at the lowest level. But when a county does something that affects other counties' abilities, then it's when the state
needs to step in. In terms of dissuading the industry. I mean, assess that piece of legislation, Matt Pierce.
Well, I supported it. I have to admit that I'm a strong supporter of local control, so I wanted to make sure we didn't have legislation that just kind of took the locals completely out of it. I mean, there is a role in the bill for the local governments within parameters. I think the problem was that these blanket bans on wind was depriving the state of both environmental and economic benefits, and so I think that we need to get to a place where we can take advantage of that. And there's an opportunity, for farmers to make significant money off the rental leases. There's more assessed value for the counties, which allows them to do more for their people as far as the, their own roads and all the services that people expect from their county government. So I think there are a lot of benefits that can come from that. And then if you just kind of step back at the big picture, if you want to get to a zero carbon energy economy, you got to find a place to put the resources to do that. And so if you take, 30 counties off the map for that possibility, that really gets in the way of that goal.
Matt Bell, I mentioned two bills we talked about. I'm guessing that you and your organization are far more concerned with the reliability, the proof of reliability of service, as opposed, for instance, to the location of wind farms. Or am I wrong?
So we follow all the work that these gentlemen do very closely, but we are paying close attention to Chairman Soliday's reliability measure. And I think it's reflective of what the task force talked about. And that was that, listen, we want markets to work. We understand that markets are real, but we have needs as a state to ensure affordability, availability, of power to Hoosier citizens. I think the mechanisms that have been put in place in Chairman Soliday's legislation are a great step in that direction, if in fact they're well implemented by our Indiana our IURC. That at the end of the day will be the most critical piece, is will they work to enact the legislation in the spirit in which it's been drafted, or does this become a check-the-box mechanism? I believe that they'll be thoughtful and thorough, but that will be critical to the success of this legislation.
And Jesse Carbonda, I know your organization certainly follows all of the bills as well, and would argue that I'm sure they're all important to you and your constituents. But in your case, I'm guessing the siting of the wind farms probably is an even more pressing issue. And that's a tough one, again, as Matt Pearce suggested, for champions of green causes and the environment. I mean, I'm not sure where environmentalists come down on that bill. You know, you're pro-wind, but, you know, a lot of people traditionally have kept used local control and local government to keep, you know, unpleasant environmental, potentially unpleasant environmental projects away. So how do you square that?
That's right. Well, first of all, we've been longstanding supporters, as you said, of utility-scale renewables, whether that's wind or solar. But it's also equally important that we think about the environmental repercussions of where these farms are located and how they're designed. And we're entering a really consequential period when it comes to solar energy. We're going to have 8,500 megawatts of solar built in Indiana over over this decade, according to the integrated resource plans of the utilities. And that constitutes anywhere from 50,000 to 100,000 acres of land. That, on average, would mean it's about the same size as the state park system in Indiana. And so it's going to have great consequence over drainage issues, stormwater issues, wildlife habitat issues, and so forth. And we'd like to have a true, authentic local control retained by local governments when it comes to the ground cover of potentially 75,000 acres.
Primarily, you're concerned about the pollinating plants and the impact on animals that need to pollinate, those plants to survive and thrive.
Right. I mean, that is certainly one aspect of the ground cover issue. We've experienced a 30% reduction in birds since the 1970s and a 90% reduction in bee colonies per acre. So solar farms, John, in other parts of the country have been used as pollinator-friendly landscapes. But we don't want the public to also we want the public to be aware of that there are many different dimensions of getting the ground cover right, which local governments have the best understanding of from the stormwater control perspective, soil and water conservation perspective, wildlife habitat perspective. Briefly, John, if I could speak to the reliability bill, we like the bill as it is, which I would think would be common ground between Representative Saladin and our organization. But I think it's important that the bill doesn't get morphed either in this session or in a subsequent session in a way that might artificially affect the decisions of utilities.
And in a way that belongs. Remaining time we have, you mentioned local control. So there's another piece of legislation or several others that touch on that. Not your bills, but you're dealing with them nevertheless. One was the upshot was that universities, for instance, that was an amendment that was added, can't pursue green projects that don't have a set return on investment. And it started, though, with a bill that would prevent municipalities and other local governments from barring new home construction from featuring natural gas hookups. Right. So, I mean, do you think the state has sort of really decided to roll up its sleeves and get involved in local businesses as it relates to the environment?
Well, I think the issue is that a number of folks saw what happened in some California cities where they banned natural gas. And the war on coal, generally what has caused coal to decline is the price of fracking, is natural gas. Not wind farms and not solar arrays. But when they saw cities banning natural gas, as I mentioned, if you were to ban natural gas up in Gary, a lot of poor people up there, they count on natural gas to heat their homes. Now somebody decides to get way in front of their skis and be politically correct and ban them. We didn't want that to happen. What we wanted was the marketplace to take its natural course and not be all wrapped up in political correctness.
10 seconds, Matt Pearson. I mean, at this time, I mean, IU, your constituents there, you represent it, probably it wouldn't look kindly on being told that they bill, can't be a green-conscious
university. The introduced version of that bill was a yawner because no one in Indiana is talking about banning natural gas, and somehow this amendment shows up, which gets totally into the business of the universities and keeps them from doing things that they want to do as consumers. So you have a bill billed as, let's make sure consumers can choose their energy. Then we put an amendment in there telling universities, but you can't do that unless you meet all our crazy parameters. So that bill's crazy town, in my opinion.
I guess we need the translation guide about what bills really mean and what they purport to mean, and certainly in this topic, especially the environment. An important topic, utilities and energy, We know this week it's on top of mind for all of us. Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Ed Soliday of Valparaiso, Democratic Representative Matt Pierce of Bloomington, Matt Bell of Reliable Energy, and Jesse Carbonda of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Once again, the push is on to do away with handgun licenses, but will it pass? We'll shoot from the hip on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Indiana Lawmakers powerhouse analyst Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hanna News Service. Well, Ed, we heard a lot of talk here about energy, the environment. Where is the consumer? How does the Hoosier consumer fit into all this?
This is a huge argument, a huge battle on the regulatory front in general. And, you know, we saw from what happened this week in Texas that regulation of energy, regulation of utilities, you know, still is important these days. You know, we're seeing that some mistakes were made by the folks in Texas, and I think the people in Indiana don't want to repeat those as well. The consumer needs to be wary on both sides. The consumer needs to understand that under the proposals that are under consideration, the cost savings may not necessarily be passed on to them. They may stay a little bit higher in the food chain. And on the other side of the coin, you know, if you're talking about renewables, you've got to understand that, you know, renewables may be kind of cheap in the beginning, but that's typically because they're subsidized. But once the subsidies are reduced or removed, then the costs to the consumers go way up. And we're seeing that with ethanol, for example, where the cost started out pretty low. We saw a lot of plants locate in Indiana. And then as the talk of subsidies started to change and people said, well, why are we subsidizing these companies? All of a sudden, it became a little bit less economical to produce this particular fuel, and we started seeing plants close, costs go up. So there are trade-offs on both sides, and the consumers need to be pretty concerned, I think, about what does happen going forward. But, you know, the key thing, though, John, is the market is going to control things. We've seen the market drive the utilities from coal to natural gas over the past few years simply because of the cost.
So when NIPSCO talks about saving $4 billion, consumers shouldn't pop the cork just yet or go out and buy a new car. Anything else this week? You know, we were at another milestone in the session. You know, bills had to leave the House of Origin. What should we be looking for?
Well, hard to believe that we're approaching the midway point with such a confusing session. There's a lot of legislation that's been crammed into committee hearings in the last 7 to 10 days, with this past week, you know, Friday, the 18th being the last day. I think that's the 18th, 19th, whatever, being the last day for hearings in the Chamber of Origin. There's a lot of work that had to be done, and we're going to see a lot of work in this next week in second readings and then the final passage of bills.
So lots to stay tuned for. That's I'll answer that for you. Stay tuned. Ed, as always, we appreciate your insight. Thanks much. For more information, episode streams, and other extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and I thank you for joining us. Until next week, take care.